there's a few things that work to our advantage, I'll say, broadly. Mm-hmm. One is that we paid them, and we don't hide from that in the film. We put their price tags up on the screen.
Some of them were pretty expensive.
Yeah, some of them were quite. They were all way more expensive than they should have been. We paid them more than they were worth. Because this thing is a grift. It's a scam. Mm. And that's part of what we're trying to expose. So we fully embrace the fact that we paid them. And I think maybe they get dollar signs in their eyes and they're willing to overlook things that otherwise would be red flags. I am the man, sick with the slang, sick and I'm destined for fame. Do for the fam, not for the gram, stunt me, you're destined for pain. I do not front, I do not scam, put some respect on my name. Sick like Cobain, click and I bang, y'all gon' remember the name. Y'all gon' remember the name. What's up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls around the world? I'd like to welcome you back to the Real Talk with Zuby podcast. On today's episode, we have got on a returning guest. He is here in person. We are in studio in Nashville, and this is the one and only Matt Walsh. Welcome back to the show, man.
Great to be here, man. Thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure, man. Last night, we had the premiere of your new movie, Am I Racist?
A lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun.
And stayed out a little too late, probably. I'm an old man now, so I can't do this getting back at 2 a.m. thing.
Yeah. But
You have a movie every once in a while, so you gotta celebrate it.
No doubt, man. Well, you've starred in a couple of movies now, and first of all, I want to say that it's awesome. It's genuinely hilarious.
I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah. So, what made you want to make this movie?
Well, I guess the last time I talked to you was What Is Woman? Was our first film, and in that we're tackling gender ideology, which is in the culture war. That's one of the big areas, one of the big battlefields. And after we made that film, that was my first film, my first experience, communicating a message through that medium. And we found it to be such a powerful tool, in a way that some of the other, of course, I do commentary on a daily basis. I do a daily podcast. And there's, that's effective, I think. There's a place for that in the culture. I think that can have an impact. I wouldn't do it if it didn't. But I think when you get into entertainment and you make a film and you see that you can do something that has an impact that lasts longer, one of my daily podcasts, if it has an impact, it probably lasts about 12 hours. Mm. Everybody forgets about it and then moves because the news cycle moves so fast. But when you see the power of filmmaking, once you do that, at least for me, it's like I got to keep – it's almost addicting in a certain way. You got to keep at it. So we started thinking about what do we want to tackle next? And it seemed kind of obvious that one of the other big battlefields right now in the culture, unfortunately, is race and specifically this DEI anti-racism grift, as I see it. So it was kind of an easy thing to choose, that this is what we want to pick as our next area to explore. The big question was, how do we get into it? How do we approach it? Because What Is a Woman was more me skeptically asking questions, kind of a blank slate through the whole thing, not agreeing with anything I was told, but also not really disagreeing, just asking questions until the end. With this, we thought, number one, not wanting to just repeat the same thing from What Is a Woman, but also just the issue itself probably calls for a different approach. And so we decided that probably the best way to do this is for me to go in and not be skeptical at all, in fact, but to just agree with whatever they tell me when I start on my own personal, journey of racial awakening, and kind of let these people that I talked to in the film, let them guide me down the rabbit hole. We wanted to end up with a film that feels like it builds, and one thing leads to another, leads to another, leads to another, until you end up in a place that's just, unexpected and wild and hopefully funny.
We all know that in today's fast-paced world, it's harder than ever to live a healthy lifestyle. Just about everyone is struggling with gut issues, stress, inflammation, fatigue, or immune issues. Most of it comes down to diet, but getting nutrient-rich food consistently isn't always easy or affordable. With hectic schedules, processed foods, and the rising cost of healthy options, we all need a cheat code as the game of life gets more difficult. My cheat code is Optimal Human. With over 90 ingredients, including powerful vitamins and other nutrients, one serving of Optimal Human helps me fulfill my daily nutritional needs. And in my opinion, it tastes better than many of the other green supplements on the market. Optimal Human contains powerful superfoods like organic reishi mushroom for your brain, turmeric root for your joints, beetroot for cardiovascular health, CoQ10 for cellular health, and probiotics for gut health. It's simple to integrate into your daily life. Just add one scoop to water, a smoothie, or your protein shake and get an instant, delicious nutrient boost. Try Optimal Human today and get 50% off your first month by going to optimalhuman.com/Zuby. That's optimalhuman.com/Zuby, and you'll get 50% off your first month. Go check it out.
It's one of those movies where I felt the same with What is a Woman, and I'm not saying this to gas you up, but only you could, you're one of the only people who could pull off something like that because of your demeanor and the ability to maintain a poker face. There are certain moments in there I was just like, there's no way on earth I would be able to keep a straight face during some of those interactions. I would have just given the game away.
Yeah, well, and everyone kind of assumes that the hard part is keeping a straight face, which it's not for me. And part of that is, as you know, I've been, even Jeremy Boring, our CEO, introed me yesterday and said that I'm a sociopath. He says it was with love. And, you know, there's probably, maybe there's an element of that, but I don't experience regular human emotions. But the other thing is that when you're making, really with both films, especially with this one, watching it back, it's very, I laugh watching it back. It's funny, even as a person who, and I've seen the movie now like 20 times. Yeah. But when you're in the room with these people, it's not really that funny. In real time, you know, when you're sitting there with them, the humor is after the fact. Because when you're in it, it's like, these are very unpleasant people, let's say. And the things that they're saying are really horrific, actually. And so it's more outrageous, infuriating, pathetic, sad. You know, those are the emotions you feel in the moment. Awkward also, which I am making it more awkward intentionally, a lot of these interactions. And then you leave, it's like, yeah, there's not much of a temptation to start breaking out in laughter. That's all after the fact. Finding the comedy and the humor in it after it's all done.
Yeah, I get that. I have to ask the obvious question, which is, how on earth did you manage to set that up? Because as I was watching it, I was like, I mean, Matt is one of the most prominent conservative commentators in the country, particularly after What is a Woman went out there. So how were you able to, you don't have to give the whole game away if you don't want to, but how were you even able to arrange some of those meetings and situations?
Yeah, it was with great difficulty was one of the answers. Of course, I can't give away the whole, sure. I can't give away all of our methods, or I'd have to kill you as you might expect.
I'm trying to stay alive.
And I don't like my chances killing you if I don't have to bring a weapon on me. So, there's a few things that work to our advantage, I'll say, broadly. Mm-hmm. One is that we paid them, and we don't hide from that in the film. We put their price tags up on the screen.
Some of them were pretty expensive.
Yeah, some of them were quite, they were all way more expensive than they should have been. We paid them more than they were worth. Because this thing is a grift, it's a scam. Mm. And that's part of what we're trying to expose. So we fully embrace the fact that we paid them. And I think maybe they get dollar signs in their eyes and they're willing to overlook things that otherwise would be red flags. I'm not sure. And the other part, too, that I always say to this question is that these people live very insulated lives. Mm. You know, they're coming from academia. They're coming from the corporate world. They're coming from very left-wing spaces. Yeah. And they probably aren't around normal people. And they're certainly not around conservatives, like, ever. Which means, number one, to them, it's kind of unthinkable that they'd ever be in a room with someone who would challenge them mm-hmm. or try to expose them in any way, because they never are in rooms with those sorts of people. And number two, probably a lot of them really didn't know who I was, because, you know, if all you pay attention to is left-wing media and you're in your kind of ivory tower bubble, I probably go under the radar. I mean, so we sat, you know, sitting in the room with Robin DiAngelo. She asked me my name. I said it was Matt. Mm-hmm. I had the costume is not very elaborate. I admit it's not like we're doing facial prosthetics and all that kind of stuff. So, and she was, you could tell in the interview, she started a little bit, she wanted to know who we were. Mm. And I'm sitting there, the costume's not that convincing. I say my name's Matt. And she still goes through with it. And I assume that's because she probably just had no idea who I was.
Yeah. I was amazed that you got Robin DiAngelo in there. As soon as I saw her in the trailer, I was just like, oh gosh, this is going to be something else.
Yeah, we knew we knew when we got her. Obviously, when we decided to make this movie, we knew she was one of the people we wanted to get in it. We had our wish list, you know. And I didn't think we would. I thought she was like, she's kind of the white whale, pardon the expression. So I didn't think we'd get her, but she was on the wish list. She was really at the top of it, honestly, because she's the godmother.
The queen of it.
Yeah, guru of this stuff. But we knew if we got her, then we got to do something with it, that we've got to make it count. I didn't want to just go in there and ask questions and have her give her pat, you know, standard cliche answers, because that'd be really boring, but also it's just a total wasted opportunity. So we sat down and, you can never script these things out because we don't know what the other person is going to say or do, but we had some, I don't want to give anything away, even if there already are spoilers, you know, out there in the world, but we had a kind of a broad outline that we wanted to go down, and we knew where we wanted it to lead. I knew what the end point was going to be for this interaction with her, and we got there.
You did get there. Oh, I have a question. I mean, during this entire process and all the research that you've done into this, what's the best way to put this? Obviously, we've talked about this being a grift and a scam, but what percentage of the people in that world do you think are genuinely well-meaning versus people who are not really true believers, but they recognize that they can make money, gain social status, and promote a sort of agenda with this all?
It's hard to say because you can't read their minds.
Yeah,
I think that all of them have to believe it at some level, just psychologically. I think as a human being, I don't think you can just tell yourself that, oh yeah, I'm a scam artist. Maybe some people can.
I think some people can.
Some people can, yeah. But I think that probably most people need to be able to convince themselves, need to rationalize it just so you can, you know, keep functioning in the world and sleep at night. So I think that it's like 75% a full-on grift for them where they know what they're saying isn't true. And then there's the 25% where they tell themselves that, yeah, a lot of this stuff isn't true. A lot of this stuff might be surface level harmful, but it's for the greater good. Mm-hmm. And so this is what we have to do in order. So I think they probably tell themselves that. I don't know how, I don't think they believe much of the sort of doctrines of the anti-racist world, but I do think they believe in their own moral superiority. I think they believe in that. So that's the part that's authentic. Like they really do. And they'll make a show of humility, especially the white. If you talk, Robin DiAngelo, if you talk to one of these DEI anti-racist experts who's white, they'll always make a show of faux humility. So you can't, you know, you can't trap them by saying, well, you're white and you're sitting there telling other white people what to do. Where do you come off? Because they'll welcome that. They'll say, "Oh well, absolutely, you're right. I'm part of the problem. I'm the worst of all. I'm the greatest sinner." They love that moment. They love to do that. But behind all of that, it's very self satisfied. It's very, you know, it's very,
it's like the ultimate virtue signal.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like the Pharisees. You know. It's and that's what it is. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. I know. I asked you this question when it came to what is a woman, and as it pertains to the whole transgender ideology. But when it comes to this line of thinking and belief, what do you think it is that's so dangerous about it?
I think it's. I mean, take your pick. Really, I think that. With this in particular, you have people that are intentionally trying to and successfully, in fact, succeeding in stoking racial guilt, resentment, suspicion, unhealthy obsessions. That's what they want to do because they profit off of it. And there's a lot of influence and power to be found in it. They have a vested interest in creating that sort of environment in society. I think if we got to a point where, you know, I'm not saying we're going to get to some post-racial utopia, that's not going to happen. And we, you know, and that, so we have to be realists about it. But, and you're always going to have, like, things like racism are always going to exist in the world because we're human beings. But if we got to a point in society where things were basically okay with the you know, racial issues, and most people weren't all that focused on it, and we weren't going around every day talking about racism, and if we got to that point, well, these people would be out of a job. Yeah. And more importantly, that it's a tool of control and manipulation that's been taken away from them. And so they don't want that, which is why I think, you know, if you were to track sort of race relations in America, it seems like there was a progression. Things are improving, you know, through the 20th century to get to the 90s. 90s, not perfect. I mean, you had OJ, you had race riots in LA, but it really seemed like things were getting better. Yeah. Into the early 2000s. And then you get to Obama. And I'm certainly not the only person who's noticed that right around that time is where things started to go back the other direction. I mean, it wasn't long after Obama's into his second term when BLM popped up and all these things. Yeah. We started hearing about these alleged police brutality cases all the time, whereas before it was like every once in a while you'd hear.
And I think a lot of it is the rise of smartphones and social media as well, which came around that time. So everyone walking around with a camera and a video camera with them at all times, and then all of these things being on camera.
Yeah.
In many cases, I think that seeing something on video versus just hearing a story hits very differently for people in psychology. And I think it makes them feel like almost like they witnessed it themselves.
Yeah.
Rather than, oh, this is, you know, just an article that I'm reading.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I think that does play into it. You're right. Well, anytime you're dissecting any kind of cultural change or shift, it's impossible to overstate the influence of social media and smartphones. I mean, it just changed everything. It changes the way people interact. It changes everything about being a human in the world. I mean, because it's a technology that really has no analog. There's nothing that existed like it before, you know, because you could always say, well, cars changed the world. They did. But before that, there were horses, and cars are just a faster version of horses than they are. But with social media and smartphones, you can't really look back at something else and say, well, this is just a new version of that. It's really not. I mean, you had phones before, but you had nothing at all comparable to carrying something around in your pocket that gave you instant access to everything in the world, essentially. So anyway, that's part of it. But I also think that the Obama years contributed to this, because I think what happened was, you know, you had these race hustlers who talked about systemic racism in America. America's systemically racist. Then we elect a black president, and to any normal, rational person, you would look at that as evidence. Now, I was not an Obama supporter, but you would at least think that, okay, well, we elected a black president. That's pretty good evidence that systemic racism is not an issue we have to worry about anymore. Mm-hmm. A black guy made it all the way to the top of the system. So clearly, you know, this is systemic racism was not something we have to think about, which, of course, it is evidence of that. But the race hustlers said, well, but we can't lose that. We can't lose that cudgel to beat people with. And so they had to actually ramp up their race hustling, yeah, you know, in order to convince people that, no, yeah, we have a black president, but no, America's still racist. So they had to desperately, like, grasp for other examples. And so that's where BLM comes from. And that's when we started hearing about all these police brutality cases that were not police, you know, Michael Brown and those sorts of things.
Yeah, it's one of the weirdest things that I've noticed is that in the past decade, I've heard the word racism and racist and the term white supremacy. I've heard them more in the past decade, certainly in the last 6-7 years, let's say, than at any other time in my life. And it seems like the better the situation gets, the more people scream and the more that they dilute the terminology as well. Like when I was, if I think back to when I was a teen or in my early 20s, if I heard that somebody was racist, or I heard that, certainly I heard someone was a white supremacist or supported white supremacy, that had a really deep and specific meaning. And now we've reached a point where you can be, I've been called a white supremacist multiple times, which is for very obvious reasons. It's just, it's laughable. You've gotten to the point where they're talking about multi-ethnic white supremacy and how black people can be white supremacists and Asians can be white supremacists. And it doesn't matter. It's not even about being a white person. It's just that if you don't want to completely destroy everything in the system and blow it all up, and you yourself don't think all white people are racist, or you question the concept of white privilege or whatever, and now you're either a white supremacist, you're a white supremacist adjacent, or you're supporting the system and all this kind of stuff. And I mean, it's laughable on one side, like the film, but also there's something deeply insidious and perverse and anti-human about it all. And so it's funny. It's like the transgender ideology. It's laughable on one side, but it's deeply insidious and dangerous on another.
Yeah, it certainly is. And just picking up on that point, because you're right, the last 10 years, it's like we're hearing conversation about it more than ever before, which is weird, because it's like the farther we get away from a time when there was actually systemic racism in America, in Jim Crow, you know, slavery. But the farther we get away from that time, the more we hear about it, which is a very strange thing. It's almost like what we're led to believe, that somehow the legacy, the wounds of the Jim Crow era or slavery are fresher now than they were for people 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. We see the same thing with the Civil War. You know, I've remarked on this many times. It's a very bizarre phenomenon, especially if you don't really understand where it comes from, where you have these Confederate monuments or even just Civil War monuments that had been, you know, erected and built, put up in cities across America, especially in the South. Sometimes have been there for like 100 years. Mm-hmm. And nobody cared. It was not a subject of controversy. It was fine, because 100 years ago, people felt like, well, we're far enough away from the Civil War where we don't, you know, it's the wounds are not fresh anymore. That's how people felt 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. But now, we are less able to be rational and unemotional about the Civil War than people were 100 years ago. These are people that, you know, they had parents who fought in the war. This is at a time when you had people that were actually slaves still living. Mm-hmm. And yet somehow now we are more emotional about it than they were. It doesn't make any sense. Why is it that, you know, your grandparents could walk by a statue of Robert E. Lee and be fine with it, but you can't? Like, it's harder for you than it was for your grandparents. But that just speaks to what we're talking about, this concerted effort by these race hustlers to, and this is, you know, regardless of, I use the Confederate, regardless of how you feel about the monuments and all that kind of stuff, this is where it comes from, though. It comes from this concerted effort to kind of get people to focus on these issues in a really negative way.
Yeah, it's interesting because we're having all these conversations, and at the same time, like, we all exist in the real world. And I'm not American, but I spent a lot of time in the USA. I've met I don't know how many thousands of people here. I've been to 25 states at this point and many dozens of cities. And I see just how day-to-day Americans live in all these different cities, and for the most part, people are decent and people get on with each other. If it's interesting, because if you're outside the US and you're just on social media and you're watching YouTube videos and seeing, it always looks like, you know, it's on the verge of a civil war and everything's going to collapse and there's a race war and the left versus right and this versus that and men versus women. And it looks super chaotic and everything that's going viral is horrible and it's nasty and it's divisive and so on. And then you you get there and you walk around and you talk to people and you're just like, there's problems, but the vast majority of people, regardless of their background, their race, their ethnicity, whatever it is, people get on. Not everyone's like going to be best friends with each other, but people are generally polite and civilized and can coexist fine. So there's this weird juxtaposition where it looks there's these deep insidious problems, and there are things that are happening in colleges and at schools and all of that's going on. But then you just kind of walk around day to day, and it seems like, if it were not for the information that's being fed to me through this device, I might not even be aware that these conversations are going on and that people are having these type of issues. So I don't know what you make of that.
Yeah, well, I think that's one thing we try to bring out in the film. We have a section in the film where we go, of course, we're dealing with these so-called experts from the corporate world and academia for much of the film, but we wanted to go and talk to people that live outside of that whole world and probably have not really been exposed to it much because they don't work in corporate America. They are not college students. Many of them probably didn't go to college. And so that's a section of the film. We go to a biker bar, Confederate flags hanging on the walls and everything, but just a bunch of white guys, bikers. We go and talk to them, and then we go immediately down to New Orleans, the poor black community in New Orleans. And what we discovered, and we didn't script this, it's not like you didn't tell people what to say, but they sound, when we ask about these issues, they have the same responses. In fact, almost verbatim, we heard from both places. We all bleed the same. It was kind of their, and the message is the same. Look, I'm not focused on the race that much. If you're black or white, we can be friends. It's fine. That's the message of most people. And then not only that, but it's almost like they don't even speak the same language as these race hustlers. Because when you ask about
centering your whiteness,
decentering whiteness, or even, and that was, and that was a flop. Not many people even understood what that meant.
No.
Because it doesn't mean anything, by the way. Even something that probably to you and I seems more ubiquitous, a more ubiquitous concept like systemic racism, I was actually a little bit surprised to find that even that, in these areas, it's like they've never even heard the term. They're like, what do you mean?
It's a very academic term.
Right. You have to explain what it means. And there's one of my favorite scenes in the movie, personally, is down in New Orleans, we talked to this car mechanic whose name is Milton. And we were just walking by, and this guy was outside of his shop, just kind of sitting there. And we said, can we talk to you? And he was very, very friendly guy. I'm throwing these ideas at him, and he's just kind of laughing at it. But in a warm, he's laughing at me, because I'm kind of presenting myself as someone who believes in these ideas, and he's laughing at it in a very, I don't want to say patronizing. It's like almost paternalistic. Oh, you poor man, you poor confused man. And it really reminded me a lot of, there's a scene in What Is a Woman where we try to get, again, far outside, in this case, even farther outside of the bubble. We go to the Maasai tribe in Kenya.
Yeah.
And I'm throwing these ideas about gender and gender constructs at them. And it's the same kind of thing. They're just kind of laughing at it. And I could even feel when we left, because we never told them. In any movie, we don't tell them at the end that what this really is. It's like, because we want to maintain the authenticity of it. But even leaving that tribe, they felt sorry for me. They were like, this guy is confused. We want to help him. And they're just laughing in a kind of warm-hearted way at these ideas. And that's how people, again, if you're outside the bubble, that's just naturally how you respond to this stuff.
Yeah, it's how most people see it. I mean, it's interesting for me because, my family background is Nigeria, and I have lots of family aunts and uncles, cousins who are in Nigeria. And I myself grew up and live currently in the Middle East. And when I talk to people who are not very online people, there's a general awareness because they see bits and bobs popping up from things that are happening in Anglo-Western countries. So they have some idea of some of these debates and things. But when you just sort of explain to them how much time and energy is spent on some of these conversations and debates and the things that are being promoted and pushed in schools and pushed at universities and pushed via the media, it's typically bemusement. It's just sort of a, don't you guys have real problems? Like, why are you spending all of this time and all of this energy, and you've got so many smart, intelligent people who are just realistically wasting billions of minutes and hours of their time debating stuff that we really worked out a pretty long time ago. These are concepts that you can explain to a four-year-old. And I think, speaking of four-year-olds, I think just like with the transgender agenda, I think that's the part that's really insidious, is the way that it's being pushed and promoted towards children. I don't know exactly what it was like when and where, you know, where you grew up, but I grew up in Saudi Arabia, and from day one, big expat community, I was just surrounded by everyone from the beginning. Preschool, like, I can look at my preschool photos and it looks like a mini UN or something. You've just got kids of all different colors, nationalities, ethnicities, parents of different religions, and no one ever cared about any of this stuff. In fact, I remember as a child maybe being like, maybe I was 8 or 9 years old, the first time I learned about the concept of racism. And I was just like, again, I was just confused. I was like, wait, so some people don't like other people because they're a different color, or they think that has some, it always confused me. And that's kind of, I think growing up in that environment, yes, I can understand human tribalism and psychologically why some of these things and biases can exist, but it's just weird to be here in 2024 and people who are supposed to be academics and who call themselves, you know, educated, the people who have done the work, they're the ones who are kind of going back to this sort of very primitive idea of, you know, someone being white means this, someone being black means this, and you need to actually treat each other differently and speak to each other differently. Like, to me, it's not just silly and wrong. I think it's deeply anti-Christian, and it's very dehumanizing in a way. And I think it's kind of offensive on all fronts. I think it's offensive regardless of what color you are. It's offensive in a different way.
Yeah, I think it's all those things. You know, we could spend an hour on each of those, dehumanizing anti-Christians. It's all those things. I had a similar experience growing up, in fact, but we mentioned it kind of jumping off in the movie, growing up in the 90s. And, you know, I went to public school in a liberal, pretty liberal area, and it was a very diverse, you know, school, people of all races and all of that. And you certainly notice when someone's of a different race, okay? But it's not a major focus all the time, and you don't have to sit around talking about how you feel about the fact that you're different races, and there's no conversation about what inherent problems a certain race might have. Mm-hmm. And the other interesting thing, too, I was thinking about recently that, and I think this is the case for many people that grew up in my generation and before that, that especially if liberals today could hear like the kinds of things that me and my friends would say to each other, we have a very diverse group of friends, right? Like we all did. Yeah. If they could hear the kind of things we would say to each other and the kind of jokes that we would tell to each other, on the surface, it's like very, they say, well, it's racist. How could you say this? But for us, the fact that, we notice each other's differences and we would ruthlessly like make fun of each other and laugh about it.
Yeah.
And that's a sign of actual progress, that you can actually laugh about these things.
I actually have a little bit of a thought about that one. Now, it's such an interesting point you make. And I think that's a very masculine thing, being able to, like, I went to boarding school from the age of 11. And everyone got it. It was just like, no matter who you are, no matter what you look like, people would find the thing about you that they can make fun of. And that's, I don't know. I don't think women do this to the girls, and women don't do this to the same degree, right?
Yeah.
Boys and men, we rib on each other. You make jokes that you kind of haze each other to some degree, and actually, that's a sign that you can be comfortable with each other and that you can trust each other, right? And you're not so frail and fragile that just being teased a little bit is going to sort of cause you to collapse. And I do wonder if, with a lot of things, including schooling, academia, I think that a lot of the things in the modern West have been shifted into a more feminine framing of everything.
Yeah.
And so what we used to just call joking around or teasing, that's now harmful, that's now toxic, that's now bullying, because it's being viewed through a more maternal lens.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. So I think you're right. And I guess that is always an important qualifier we're talking about. Well, this is the way it was when we were growing up. It's like, for this anyway, it is specifically how it was for boys growing up.
Yeah.
Because this is a male way of relating to each other that, yeah, women are always at least a little bit sort of scandalized by. And that's fine because men and women are different.
Yeah.
But that's the thing. When you're a boy and then when you grow up to be a man, this is just how – this is what you do with your friends. You ruthlessly make fun of them. And the more outrageous and offensive the insult, the funnier it is. And it's a sign of – you know, this is like a sign of affection, really.
Yeah.
You could find that even – people complain all the time. Maybe this kind of ties into these complaints about how comedy, stand-up comedy even, is dying now. It's not dead, but it's dying, and you compare it to comedy in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of jokes about this kind of thing, and it was acceptable because we understood that's what comedy is. And usually people will say, well, we became a more woke, politically correct culture, and that's why a lot of that stuff went away. But I think you've nailed that also, along with that, we've become a feminized culture.
Mm.
And all that stuff changes because it's not feminine to relate to each other that way.
Yeah. It's like you're trying to force – it's the same with schooling. You're trying to sort of force the boys into the more – be more like girls in a way, essentially.
Absolutely, that's what they're doing. Yeah.
I have a question, of course. I mean, you're a father of six.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about a lot of different issues, and I know you have so many different concerns that you talk about on your daily show, but I'm curious as to how do you navigate some of these. Well, first, I guess maybe two questions. How much do you I know your children are young. How much do you even engage in these type of conversations with your kids, and if so, when? And if you do, how do you handle that?
Yeah, it's interesting because we homeschool our kids, so they are insulated from a lot of this stuff, which I see as a good thing. There are people that say, "Well, don't raise your kids in a bubble." Well, of course, you want to have your kids in some kind of bubble. You know, it's like you want to create. The term safe space gets a bad rap for a good reason when we apply it to adults. Mm-hmm. But for kids, you actually want to create a safe space for them in your home. And as much as possible, as a parent, you don't give the world, I'll put it this way, you don't give the world unfettered access to your child.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of things in the world that you want to shield your child from, and you want to decide when these things are introduced and how they're introduced. And give your child a framework for understanding, especially the more difficult things when the time comes, and figure out when is the right age to start introducing these things. But of course we don't actually have them in a protective literal cocoon all the time. We are out in the world, so things can happen in the world that force you to have some of these conversations earlier than you want. Like this is not on race, but on the gender stuff. The first time I talked to who are now our oldest kids about transgenderism was when my daughter was five, and that's because she was with mom getting her hair done, very excited about that at some hair salon.
Mm-hmm.
And a man comes in wearing a dress and sits down in the chair next to her, and my daughter notices it because kids are perceptive.
Yeah.
and notices that this man's wearing a dress. She notices that, like, that's an odd thing. And so she had questions about it afterwards, and so we had to talk to her about it. And we tried to explain it in a really in a way that she can understand at her level, that doesn't expose her to too much. And so at the time, it was kind of a quick conversation. I said, you know, yes, there was a man wearing a dress. It's a silly thing. Sometimes people are confused, and we pray for those people that are confused. And we kind of left it at that. And then as they get older, you kind of expand a little bit on that idea. Yeah. But at least from an early age, they have that basic framework for these things. And the funny thing is about on the new film, my oldest kids are now 11, and I actually had to, when we were making this movie, they wanted to know, like, what do you, you know, they don't understand much about what I do for a living. They're kind of, because they don't, you know, they're not listeners of my podcast, you know?
Yeah.
But they know that I've made movies. And so when we told them the title of this movie, Am I Racist? My son said, well, what is that? What's a racist? Mm. He didn't know. And so it was kind of what you said earlier. I had to explain to him what that even is. Mm-hmm. And it was, for him, it was a curious thing. He said, oh, okay. So some people are, it hadn't occurred to him that people are like that.
Yeah.
And that kind of goes to show that if these race hustlers didn't exist, and if they all just shut up, somebody like my son, for example, you know, he would just go out into the world not worried about this stuff. Mm. But we know they do exist, so we have to prepare for that.
Yeah, it's so interesting because I'm curious, because I know that some black parents in particular, you know, I'm sure you've heard of The Talk.
I have heard of The Talk.
They'll sit down and have a conversation with, and I assume there's lots of different potential talks depending on the experiences and belief system of the parents. But, you know, look. You know, you're a black child in this world, and this means X, Y, Z, and other people are this, and other people are that. I've said on podcasts before that I never had The Talk with my parents. I don't think any of us did, and I think that actually served myself and my siblings very well, because we didn't sort of develop this complex that the world is out to get us, so we're going to have to work 10 times as hard to achieve the same level of results, or there's certain barriers and impediments that are going to be in our way, blocking us because of this or that. And so I just never imbibed any of that throughout my life. But I know other people where that's not the situation. So I'm just kind of curious in your, almost on the other end. I don't know if you have white children, let's say, growing up in America, is there a version of that? I'd assume the DEI folks and the people who really believe in all of the anti-racism stuff. I mean, in the movie, they say, well, is there an age that's too young to start talking to your child about anti-racism? And it's like, no, why not start talking to them as newborns, essentially, which to me seems completely psychotic. But I don't know. I'm just.
Yeah, I don't think. And what I've heard, I've heard of The Talk.
Yeah.
And I guess you're right that there are different versions of it. But one of the main versions of it that I seem to hear about is the idea that black parents have to sit down, especially their sons, mm-hmm. and tell them about the police
yeah.
and tell them about, here's how you need to conduct yourself around the cops, because they'll kill you otherwise.
Yeah.
And I always find that to be so funny. Number one, of course, you know this, but so many of the statistics we hear about so-called police brutality are just completely made up. Or misunderstood, taken out of context. So this idea that there's some sort of like epidemic of mm-hmm. cops out there murdering black men is just not true. It is not borne out by the stats. But also, which would mean that you don't need to have some big melodramatic talk with your kid about it, except to the extent that, like, there's a version of that talk that my dad gave me,
yes.
and I've been white my entire life, and I was a white, it was probably about around 16 mm-hmm. when I first got my license. Yeah, my dad had, we didn't call it The Talk. It didn't seem like a big deal, but he did sit me down and say, listen, if you get pulled over by the cops, you pull over, you say, yes, sir, no, sir, yes, officer. Yeah. You do what he says. You are respectful. And if you do that, you're going to be fine. Mm-hmm. And my dad made it clear. You start mouthing off to the cops, you're going to be in a lot of trouble with them and even more with me. Yes. And so that was – and I internalized that. And then, and then I went out and I did end up getting pulled over quite a bit because I'm a 16, 17-year-old boy and I, am not the safest driver early on anyway. Now I'm the best driver on the road. But at the time, I wasn't. And so I had several chances to put this into practice when I was a teenager, and what I discovered is that the cops pull you over if you're just cooperative, and you don't go out of your way to be a belligerent a-hole, you'll be fine, assuming you haven't actually committed some terrible crime. So it's not that's a thing that you should tell your kids.
Yes, it's not racial.
Right, there's no reason for it to be racial.
No, and I think there are times when people put a racial frame on something when it's just like a human experience. And I think people like to assume that only certain groups can even experience certain things. I see that a lot in this particular conversation where people have this idea that, only black people or only minorities can experience those types of things, because those are the only stories that go viral, even though actually they're smaller in number, right? Like I would imagine if you were to poll people in the USA and to ask them to name even one white person killed by police officers in the last decade, I would wager that most people couldn't name one.
Yeah.
But I'm absolutely certain the vast majority of people could name probably several black people, even though more white people have been killed. So that in itself is quite curious. That's actually something that was a bit of a red pill to me as well, because I remember I was in the UK, and I remember there was a time, what year would it have been? Maybe around 2015 or so, 2015, maybe 2016, there were several high-profile situations where black people had died at the hands of cops in America. And there was like, I want to say within a few months period, there were just several high-profile ones, and it did seem, based on the media reporting, that it was like, gosh, this is seeming like a bit of an epidemic. Why does this keep on happening? And I remember when I went and actually sort of looked up the stats and the data on all this, and I realized, oh, okay, like of the police killings, like the majority of these are not black. Like these are the only ones being highlighted, but there's all these other stats which are just ignored, and you don't hear those stories, and you don't see those faces, and there's no political activism around it or anything. And that was when I was just like, man, like this is, people are having the wrong conversations here. There's a conversation certainly to be had about how police treat citizens and about the proper use of force and about what is and what isn't right. But to make this as if it's just purely a racial and racist thing is incredibly misleading, incredibly divisive. And it also means you're never going to get to the root of the problem to which it exists because you're not even looking at it correctly.
Yeah, I mean, there's two things about that. One, on just staying on the police issue for a second, I think you're right that we could have a more productive conversation about police use of force and how police interact with civilians if we just took the racial framing off of it and we just and approached it that way. But then if we did that, maybe we could also start to see it from the police perspective a little bit too, because there's so much call for empathy and compassion in society, which objectively, taken in a vacuum, we would say is a good thing. We should be empathetic. It's just that the empathy is very selective in our culture, and no one ever talks about, well, maybe we should have some empathy for the cops. Mm-hmm. Think about, especially these days, the situation they're in. I can remember back in my younger days, in that rash of me getting pulled over a lot, one of those times, got pulled over for I was speeding and I was going like 15 miles over the limit. I go to the court, a couple weeks later, whenever it was, and the cop was there, and I just had a brief conversation with him, and he said, I really don't like doing this, because he was saying to me, in my job, the only time that I interact with kind of just normal people is when I'm giving them a ticket. And most of the rest of the time, I'm out dealing with domestic violence. I'm going to, you know, I'm just going to kind of deal with the dregs of humanity. That's my phrasing, not his. And so that alone, I can only imagine what kind of the psychological burden of that. And what cops are dealing with every day, even aside from all the anti-police rhetoric out there. Just imagine, like, think of all the worst people you've ever met. And they're dealing with that every freaking day. And then, so sometimes you'll see a case where a cop is probably a little bit rude or more aggressive than he needs to be. And we should call that out. But also, can't we? I can also understand. Like, if I was a cop, I'd probably be in a bad mood a lot. And I'd probably not be very patient. And sometimes I think, because they're dealing with all this nonsense all the time, they just got out, you know, they just came from a call, you know, domestic violence, some alcoholic, whatever, beating his wife and his kids. They're just coming off that call. Now they pull over some guy, and, you know, and you were speeding, I want to give you a ticket, and you're just being in absolute pain for no reason. And they just say, dude, come on, just enough of this. And I can, you know, I can have empathy. I can understand that.
Yeah, I get it. And to be honest, I think if people had that level of empathy, I think it would actually be safer. So one thing I do find kind of confusing is, you know, I'm not someone who's like anti-cop, right? I call balls and strikes. So I think police are absolutely necessary. Of course, they can go overboard sometimes. I myself have, you know, been at the hands of police misconduct. But because I conducted myself in a certain way, I'm totally okay. But I think that if someone, even more so if they have the belief that, you know, all cops are bad, or that the majority of them have this sort of horrible attitude, or that they just want to hurt people or something, it's like, wouldn't that be even more reason to be extraordinarily polite and not give them any reason to escalate to the point of physical violence? Like, to me the concept of like fighting a cop or multiple cops, it's just like, when is that going to have a good outcome? Like, there's just nothing good to come from it. In the worst case, you will be killed. In the best case, what, you might get a punch or two in, and then you'll probably be killed.
Whatever you did that caused the cop to, now you're going to be punished even more. So you're right. It's a there's no win. Like, when you run or you fight, there's no world where you end up in a better spot because of that. It's impossible. And it is true. Because that's the other irony here, is that we're told that cops are out hunting black men, and if you're black, you have to be very terrified of the cops. But then you see these interactions, and it's like, well, this is not how you'd expect someone to act if they're really afraid that cops are homicidal, racist murderers. There was the most recent thing is this Tyreek Hill incident, the wide receiver for the Dolphins, who got pulled over, and then he ended up, you know, in handcuffs on the floor, on the ground, and they're treating him, by the way, like he's some sort of martyr, like he died.
I'm not that familiar with what happened.
Yeah, it just happened. It just happened, and nothing happened. He was speeding, and he got pulled over, and rather than just take the ticket, you were speeding, take the ticket, they got you. That's it. Sorry, man. But I don't know, partly he's an NFL star. He probably feels a little bit like, what are you doing pulling me over in my hometown? How dare you? So rather than take the ticket, he's arguing with the cop. And then while the cop's talking to him, he rolls the window up in his tinted, you know, sports car, the tinted window up. And that there are many cases of cops getting shot and killed in that exact situation. Now they can't see you. They don't know. Now you roll the window up, I can't see you. I don't know what you're doing. And so the cops respond aggressively. They pull him out of the car, put him on the ground. And it's like, well, what if you're actually worried that this cop might be a homicidal lunatic, why would in the world would you do that?
Just don't give it. And you know, it's interesting, because I'm one of the few people, like most people have not experienced the type of thing I have, because I would be in a position, given something that I experienced back in 2009, I would be in a prime position to be pushing some of these narratives, but it would just be a lie. So when I was in the UK, I was coming back home one day, and as you probably know, in the UK, the typical police officers don't carry firearms, but they have special firearm units, so that if they are responding to, a potential gun situation or something that's very high profile, you know, they'll come in with their rifles and so on. And so I'm coming home, I get off of a train, and I hear shouting, I see tons of police officers and police dogs and stuff on the platform. I'm looking around trying to see what's going on. I get pushed backwards towards the train, and I look up, and I've got 6 guns trained on me.
Wow.
They're telling you, put your hand up, get down on the ground, get down on your knees. I have no idea what's going on. I've just been living my life. I'm lying down. They approach me, put me in handcuffs, tell me I'm under arrest for a Section 1 firearm offense. Da da da. I get marched off. They're interrogating me. Apparently, they're asking questions about an incident that happened in a city I hadn't been to. Something involved a firearm. I literally don't even know what they're talking about because obviously I haven't done anything. Long story short, turned out it was mistaken identity. They got completely the wrong person, and I've just gone through this whole experience. It wasn't very pleasant. But in the heat of that moment, my only thought was like, I don't even know how much I was thinking, but it was just like, stay alive, stay alive, stay alive, stay alive. Like if I run, if I do it, like I will get shot. I've got multiple guns on me. And when I tell that story to some people, it's interesting because a lot of people will just be like, yeah, like obviously you did the right thing. There's a small contingent of people who almost get kind of like angry at me for saying that, like, oh, you know, you almost like shouldn't have complied in the way you did, or you shouldn't sort of tell people that, hey, my message is, look, if you are ever, I pray no one is ever in that situation, but if you are, just comply and stay alive. Deal with the stuff later. Whatever the thing, just deal with it later. Just stay alive in that moment. Like, your heart is racing. It's very bizarre. I felt like I was in some weird dream or something. And that's the thing. Like if I just panicked or freaked out or tried to, I don't know, like grab the cop's gun or like it's right. Over, right? And I've just seen so many of these situations now in this country and outside where it would have been, whatever the situation, the shooting would be totally avoidable if there wasn't the escalation. Or no, I'm gonna try to fight, or I'm gonna just like run. And it's odd. It's where I don't know. To me, it's not even like a political thing. It's just like, look, the obvious thing to tell people in those situations is just do that, and you can complain later. Maybe you can sue them. Maybe you can do whatever. But just stay alive.
Right. It's not even. Yeah, people that would tell you, oh, you should have fought back. Well, they're really telling you, you should have died. You know, you shouldn't be here today, which is crazy. Because, yeah, what you're saying is it's not comply with injustice.
Yes.
Because in the long term, you're not complying with it. But in order to fight the injustice, if there was an injustice, if it is a mistaken identity, if your rights are being infringed on, which does happen, the way to fight the injustice, you have to be alive to fight it.
Yes.
So if you just commit suicide, which is basically what it would be to, you know, try to fight the cops when they've got guns trained on you. If you commit suicide, then you can't be alive to. It's the same thing. It's like if you're walking down the street and someone puts a gun to your head and says, give me your wallet.
Yeah.
Just give them your freaking wallet. I mean, what are you going to die for? Who are you impressing? That's not courage. That's just straight up suicide. Mm-hmm. It's not worth dying over a wallet. So you give them the wallet and. And then after the fact, you go try to find that guy, and maybe justice will be done, maybe not. But in the meantime, just throwing your life. That's the thing I see in a lot of these cases. You've got usually they're young men, who to me, I don't see when they're fighting the cops. I don't see, oh, this is a courageous freedom fighter. Mm-hmm. I see someone who does not value his own life, and it's not that he doesn't value it in a courageous. Like there's our. A firefighter rushing in to a burning building to save a child.
That's courage.
Is courage. And he's putting something above his own life, but it's not suicidal in the sense that he has no value of his own. He understands his life is valuable. He sees something that is a greater value than his own life. Mm. And he's willing to sacrifice his own life potentially in pursuit of that greater good. But when you see these young guys that are doing everything they can to get shot by the cops, what I see is they just have no value. They don't value their own life. They don't value anything.
Yeah,
it's just total nihilism. Mm. Where what's going on in their head? Are they saying to themselves, "I'm willing to die right now to take a stand"? That's not what I see. It's more like, Okay, whatever. Life doesn't matter. My life doesn't matter. It's yeah. a yeah. It's nihilism.
Are there any aspects of, I don't know, the race relations conversation in the U.S. in your perspective? Are there some areas or things where you think there is, say, a genuine problem, or there is something that, okay, something we need to do something about this? Here's something that needs like a specific approach.
I think there are genuine problems, but they're, in my mind, especially these days, they're individual. Mm. So, like, racists exist.
Sure.
There are white people out there who are actually racist. There are black people who are actually racist. People of all races can be racist. Mm-hmm. And that's a real thing. And it's not good. And so someone could claim to be the victim of racism, and it could be true. I don't think that it's like, I don't reflexively disbelieve. Now, well, I do. If I hear a claim of racism or hate crime, I do reflexively demand evidence, because it's, so often those things are hoaxes. But it could be true. It's just that, again, it's an individual thing. It's in the human heart. And you have to approach it that way. And if you're looking for systemic policy changes to make to fix what is a problem in the hearts of certain human beings, that you're not going to, all you're going to do is create more of that thing. You're going to, because now you're creating more resentment and guilt and all of that. And that doesn't help the human heart. It just turns people more, it has a hardening effect on the heart, I think.
How race conscious do you think people should be? Like, it's never going to be zero, I'd say. Because I see people both on the left side of the aisle and on the right side of the aisle who push for more racial consciousness, right? They're both against the idea of quote-unquote color blindness, which is not something to be taken literally, because we have eyes and we can see what people look like. But do you think that sort of any of that is useful and that people should go in that direction? Or do you think we should aim more for the color blindness approach?
I think if you're aiming, yeah, it's, I don't think it's something you aim for. I think you allow the level of quote unquote race consciousness that you find in, like I said, in the film, and those two scenes and those two groups of people, one white, one black, the level of, if we want to call it race consciousness that you find there, I think is pretty much where you should be. It's just a normal, you're aware of it.
Yeah.
You're not ashamed of your own race. You can be proud of being who you are, whether you're white or black. It's part of who you are. It's part of your identity. So you should be proud and happy of who you are, you know, your identity. And then you go live your life.
Yeah.
You don't have to, your life doesn't have to revolve around that. You don't have to think about it all the time. And you just kind of let it kind of float to this sort of default position that I think most people would be in if they didn't have these other people coming in telling them, you know, to focus on it.
Agreed. Matt, where can people check out the movie?
Well, it's going to be in theaters. So we're now in about 1,500 theaters. So this is a wide release, theatrical release. And look, if you want more movies like this, movies that reflect, you know, if you're conservative, reflect your values, and certainly movies that are not woke, politically correct, and all that, we all complain about it. But if you want more of those movies, you got to support the ones that when they do end up in theater. And you know, if you support this film, you'll be rewarded with what I think is an entertaining film as well. So you can go to amiracist.com to buy your tickets.
No doubt. Amiracist.com, guys. Go check it out. I've seen it. It is genuinely hilarious. Even if you're not a political person, I highly recommend seeing it. So great job on the movie, man. I really enjoyed it.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks, man.